for me, like, I do want to instill those values of like hard work, being resilient, really to my kids. I think it's important to be a good model of what it means to take care of yourself, to show up, and to experience things rather than just be on the sidelines.
What's up, everyone? Welcome to episode 109 of the Mad Happy Podcast. I'm Payman.
And I'm Mason.
And today we have a great guest. Her name is Vanessa Du, and we recorded a couple weeks ago. And for those that don't know, she's the co-founder of a super popular kombucha drink, Health Aid. And we've done a bunch of cool stuff with them, but just really inspiring to hear her story of just her background, her parents immigrating here, the entrepreneurship journey when maybe your parents don't believe in you taking that path, and just a series of ups and downs. And I think we shared a lot of similarities, both maybe in upbringing and mentality, but also in the challenges, of course, of a startup. So I think it's a really good one, a little bit different from what we usually do, but hope you guys really enjoy the episode.
Don't forget, to all of our listeners, the first 10 people to email p@madhappy.com or send a direct message to @PaymanRaff on Instagram will receive a special Mad Happy gift. Payman summer promotion is still going on, so be sure to take advantage of it while it lasts. And enjoy the episode with Payman and Vanessa. The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the show with Vanessa Du.
Today, we are lucky to have
Vanessa Du, co-founder of Health Aid. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Yeah. And, you know, for those that don't know, I mean, over the past year or so, we've worked pretty closely with Health Aid to offer it in some of our seasonal shops and coming in some stores that are coming up throughout the summer as well. And I think we were just talking before we started recording, but Health Aid, I feel like it's been quite the journey, you know, and I think we can definitely relate. I mean, we're only 6 years in, but you were telling me you got started in 2012. So I'm just curious, like, what that initial spark was for you guys back in the day.
Yeah, so initially it started, I was in business school at the time. Me and my best friends, Justin and Dinah, we were all interested in starting a business. And in business school, I'd actually started a separate concept. And I ran it by them just one day when we were having dinner. And, you know, that project ended up not taking off, but we loved talking about business together.
Yeah.
So we started this entrepreneur club. It was basically a place where we had great food, great wine, talked about opportunities, pain, solutions to businesses that we could ultimately develop. And what was the spark to Health Aid was actually Justin. He came home one day after the hairdresser, and he was really distraught, upset. He was essentially sentenced to male baldness by the age of 30.
Wow.
And we thought we were going to create kombucha as an all-natural hair loss product to cure baldness for both men and women. And so we started on our path to creating this product through kombucha. In the end, we didn't create this hair loss product, but we had an amazing product. We decided to sell in the farmer's market, make some money back. We did go to the farmer's market, sold out that day, and there started our journey in the world of kombucha.
Wow, that's crazy. And was it supposed to be like a topical product?
Yeah, so we were brewing kombucha with the SCOBY, so the symbiotic culture bacteria and yeast, we're using as a hair mask. Mm. So we were trying to brew this culture, really high quality kombucha culture, put it on his head, see if he lost any hair after that. We were washing his hair. It was ridiculous. It was, you know, his hair, the dog's hair, whose hair was it? But we thought we were going to create a hair loss mask.
And what was like the thing, like, was there some research at that time around kombucha's effects there?
Anecdotally, kombucha is supposed to be good for a lot of different things. Oh, yeah. Hair loss is one of those anecdotal things. And so we thought we can brew kombucha. My partner is a nutritionist, so she had a recipe. And so we thought we could do this at home and just try it out and see where it got us.
Wow.
So it got us here.
That's pretty cool. I feel like, you know, especially when I was growing up and, you know, I know Health Aid launched in 2012, and that was like when I graduated high school and then going to school in college for the next 4 years. Like, that was sort of the beginning of the heyday for kombucha. And I think there were so many like misconceptions about what kombucha is. So like, how do you now try to explain it to someone who maybe doesn't know, which is rare in LA, but outside maybe.
Yeah. So we like to say it's a fermented tea rich in probiotics and healthy acids, and really trying to take out the deep science of it to keep it light, to keep it something that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's good for the gut. So really just saying it's great for the gut, rich in probiotics, and keep it as simple as that. Because at the end of the day, we don't want to make people's eyes glaze over when we're talking about bacteria and your, you know, microbiome.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to find a way to tap in to what makes people feel good and in a way that they understand it.
Especially with the average consumer, it's like they just want to know, you know, kind of like, what can I expect? What is it going to taste like? And how does it make me feel, right? Similar to us, I think we've led very much with optimism. And I think for people who dig deeper, it's like the story around mental health and everything we're doing around that. And I think for you guys, for people that dig deeper, they can see the science if they're interested, but you're not forcing it upon people.
Yeah, not at all. And even our tagline, follow your gut, was meant to be this kind of double entendre in that we want people to follow their gut to, you know, good gut health, but also you're following your gut with what you believe to be true, with that kind of true north. And it leads to kind of that optimistic what could be feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. Something that's, you know, being in LA for me, I think over the last 5-6 years, you've seen so many beverage brands launch, which is just like, it's a funny thing. You know, when I was in college, I was just like, oh, it's such an interesting space to go into. And now it's become so crowded with so many drinks saying so many different things. I feel like you guys were super early in that. So like, you know, what was the thinking on why, you know, why a beverage, and then how to use a beverage to tell a bigger story? Because I think like traditionally, like you think of, oh, I go to the supermarket and I buy a drink, and maybe they have this like global, like Coke does their campaigns, but like there's not like that connection or like part of your lifeness. So what was the initial thinking there? Because I feel like it was quite early.
Yeah. So like I said, with the failed hair loss product, we pivoted to the beverage because it was tangible. It was something that we knew that we could put into a bottle and sell it easily at the farmer's market. So we did just that. And beverages are such an interesting product to understand, like, human behavior and psychology, too. That impulse buy, like, what they get connected with, that psychology goes deep. And
yeah,
we didn't know that at the time, but we knew that we wanted to create a brand, not just a product or a Me Too product. And so we used to tell ourselves that we're marketers at the end of the day, not manufacturers, even though we made kombucha. And it's because we're tapping into that psyche around what people connect with, why people choose a brand. And we wanted to healthy to stand out on the shelves. We didn't want it to be very alternative. We wanted to make it mainstream. We wanted to make it fun and light and something approachable, something that people loved carrying around because it was like a badge of honor that they were a part of that kind of tribe. And so that's why it looked the way it looked. And we had the tagline of follow your gut because we wanted people to pick up the product, look into the brand, feel connected to either our entrepreneurial story, what follow your gut meant to them as individuals. And it was that deeper connection that we knew we were trying to build individual by individual. And that's kind of the cool part about brand building and how beverages, you know, even though you drink it and take two sips and you're done, you may feel just part of that family and that community and proud of the brand that you're imbibing. So that's the cool part of beverages. It really taps into who you are.
For sure. I think the practice of a beverage, like entering your routine, is super cool because it's now part of your life. And I think for us, it's like an example would be, yes, sure, you know, people wear Mad Happy a few times a week, but maybe they wear the hat like every day of the week. And it's part of their daily routine of, you know, who they are, how they want to express themselves. And I feel like drinks in a way became that in the physical form because you're carrying it. So like, what does it mean, you know, that you're carrying that drink? What does that say about you? I think that didn't really exist maybe as much before, you know, because I think the brands were so limited. You know, it was like Coke and Pepsi and all the brands they owned and that was it. So it's pretty awesome. I also feel like having a physical product as like the vessel for like how you tell the story and the marketing that you can do through that, it's like so much harder to tell all those stories around like follow your gut and intuition without like a tangible thing. Because like humans, I think it's very hard to like feel that unless you're like, oh, I'm wearing this hoodie, or oh, I have this drink, or oh, I just tasted this drink for the first time. So I definitely agree with what you meant there.
Yeah, and it's a whole experience you create, right? Early on, we did a lot of pop-ups at demos and stores, and we got to not just try the product with customers, but also tell that story. And there was that kind of hand-to-hand interaction that people felt connected with. And I know MedHappy does the same in many of its campaigns.
Yeah, I think it's cool that, you know, a drink, I mean, the first drink I remember personally, like, feeling like, oh, like, this is cool. It was like vitamin water when mm-hmm. I was growing up. And I was like, I think they're like the first, maybe one of the first examples, at least my age, that I was like, oh, like this is like a brand new drink. They're not like owned by one of these huge brands, but they did such a good job of like the feeling around that. And they did a good job of like inserting themselves into the culture. And then I think thinking through that is like, then these like new ideas came, whether it was a kombucha or a CBD or probiotics, prebiotics, everything that people are doing now. And like, watching those movements unfold has been quite interesting.
Yeah, I love it. And that's kind of that psychology and that presence in popular media that you see come true. I totally agree. Smart water was big when we were in college.
Yeah.
And I remember all my friends like, if I drink this, I'm going to totally pass my LSATs.
Yeah.
I'm like, sure. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, you think about some of the brands that are doing a good job now, like even outside, maybe not direct competitors, but like a Liquid Death is so interesting because it's very similar to smart water, which is just like, how do you position water in a different way and like access a different type of consumer? And it's like, it is all marketing, right?
Yeah,
and
it is
all like how you make people feel.
Yeah, and I love Liquid Death's marketing platform. They chose a lane and they're going hard into it. And that takes balls. And I love
For sure.
that type of energy from a founding team, just what you're able to bring to the table and believe in it, have that vision and go.
Yeah. And I'm curious, like one thing I always remember about kombucha as well is like the price point, you know, for health aid, especially early days was a little bit on the higher side. And I think now people are maybe used to paying a little bit more for drinks, but at the time it was a new thing. So how did you guys think about that in terms of how you wanted to position the brand? And I know it was like, the message was also like, you don't have to drink it all in one sitting and it lasts in that way. But how did you think about that? Because you were trying to have someone choose a kombucha maybe over like a $1 or $2 drink.
Yeah. So we always knew and thought of ourselves as a premium beverage, a premium kombucha at that. And so we signaled that not just through price point, but also where we showed up, who we had in terms of talking about the product.
Right.
And it was through those outlets that you just gradually also believed in the product and you wanted to pay more.
Yeah.
Because not only did you believe in the quality of what we're delivering every single time, but also you believe the people who were drinking it and ambassadors of the brand. And it was that type of community around quality kombucha, what healthy was about, the message that we are really putting out to our audience, and people felt good about paying that because I think at the end of the day, they felt good with kombucha.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like their body felt good and they wanted to treat themselves too. So it was more about that type of messaging to tap into. They were going to be believers no matter what, even if they had to save up for it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I remember, and what's cool about even premium beverages is maybe the price is 2x a normal beverage, but the actual cost is not super, super high. So I think everyone can try it, which is awesome, you know?
Yeah.
And one thing I remember is like, you guys would have these like coupons that were like in the form of like the bottle.
Yeah.
And it felt like a very, like you said, like premium type version of like, you know, it did the same thing as like a paper coupon or whatever, but like felt pretty cool and you could pass them out easily and was like a good way to like get people to try it. And also understand kind of the form factor and all that stuff. So I thought that was amazing as well.
Yeah, thank you. And it was, that's another good point. Everything that our ideal was, we wanted to come through in every touch point with the consumer. So the coupons are a great example. It wasn't that flimsy paper. It was that cardboard stock.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, this is a meaningful coupon that I want to use. So it had to infiltrate every part of our touch point.
Yeah, and I think what I always admire about great CPG brands in general is that, you know, it is a lot harder to control the environment that your product shows up in because, you know, it's a retailer for the most part, right? Outside of your e-com. And so it's like, how do you get the brand message across? And it's like, for us, like we've been so controlled, we have really no external retailer. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot easier, you know?
Yeah.
I think for any CPG brand that's been successful, you have to be in all those locations or else no one sees your product, right? And like, how do you market in a way where, whether it's the bottle or the colors or just like the feeling, you know, how did you think about that? Because I've always found that challenging. Like, I'm super into all the new beverages that come out, and I'm always just like interested how they're trying to position, you know, slightly differently amongst like this sea of new brands.
Yeah. And so, you know, I had that same fear. I remember in the early days, I had to hold back the floodgates and basically said no to a lot of retailers where we just weren't ready for, because maybe that consumer wasn't ready or the geography wasn't ready. So we had to say no at times. Like, for example, we couldn't show up in the southeast of the United States just yet. They weren't ready for it.
Right.
But I remember in our first big account, it was like 500 stores on the East Coast. I was worried that, like, how are we going to show up and communicate that message of follow your gut, quality kombucha, probiotics to the consumer? And you're right, it does come through the packaging. It has to evoke premium. It has to say exactly what you want to say that the consumer is going to pick up in like three words.
Yeah.
And then all your other channels have to support it. And that is everything, including field marketing, digital marketing, kind of the disruption points within a store. So I always told my team, it was you have to own the store. It's not just your 3 feet of real estate on the, you know, shelf that you're relegated to. We have to be at the check stand. We have to own a refrigerator right when you walk in. You have to be next to the apples, next to the refrigerator. You know, you just, I was at a conference, and there's 7 points of disruption for a consumer before they actually want to buy something. And so if you think about that, you have to be ever present in their life. And I think that's really how brands start to scale, and you see them more and more.
Yeah, and even if they don't like consciously like notice your brand, I think I totally agree. Like, showing up in as many of those spots as you can is the only way, because the chances of them coming across the product, like a beverage is really hard to like see in the wild maybe, but seeing it in that store environment that so many people are in daily, like 5 or 6 times every time you go, that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. And I just remember my team, and you know, bringing it back to optimism, someone's like, how are we going to talk to the consumer in you know, Virginia? I was like, we got to try. And so it was like, let's pick the one store, go deep, own that store, own the stores around that store, and just talk to that consumer. And it was like the possibility of what if.
Yeah.
And that manifestation and that possibility really rung true as we did it more and more.
Yeah, it's such a local game with beverage as well, I feel like, you know, because most people consume beverages that they come across or their friend is drinking. So like, if it's not physically in that market, it's super hard for them to know about your Instagram or know about everything you're doing online. So you have to like build it up in each community, and it's hard because sometimes you fail in a community and then you have to go try a new one in a new way, right?
Yeah, I mean, I tell a lot of the brands advice today. I was like, it's very alluring to say yes to like the 2,000 stores of Target across the US, but if you haven't gone deep in an area like LA or New York or even Chicago, if that's where your consumer is, like, you haven't gone deep with that consumer. And so you got to be careful on how you're building that community.
Yeah. I want to bring it back to your story. I'd love to hear about just you growing up, sort of your family, siblings, anything that like really you feel like shaped you into eventually becoming who you became and starting the brand.
Yeah, so I grew up in Southern California. I feel like I'm one of the few non-transplants here. But I am also Asian American, and I grew up in the Valley. And I was probably one of the few Chinese people, even in my school. I knew 0 Chinese people in the Valley, actually. Yeah.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Louisville. It was an all-girls high school.
Got it, awesome.
And so that in of itself was a sheltering experience. But I just remember growing up feeling like I was part of two worlds. Mm. One in which I was very much part of the local community playing sports, all girls, very homogenous community where I was the token Chinese person. but then also I was very traditional in my upbringing in that we went to go eat Chinese food every weekend. We saw, you know, my family very often. We went to the temple. And so I very much felt like I was growing up in two worlds. I also felt like I was growing up with a very traditional family who wanted boys. You know, me and my sister were, you know, two strong-willed girls, now women, and that wasn't really the desire. Although I know my parents love me, it's just I very much grew up with that feeling of knowing where I was and where I wasn't, what I should or shouldn't be.
Yeah.
And so I didn't realize at the time, hindsight's always 20/20, but yeah. I feel like that really shaped who I am today.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, is your sister younger?
Mm-hmm.
How many years apart?
Almost 4 years.
Nice, yeah. I mean, I feel like, especially as the older sibling, I'll share my story in a sec, but I'm curious, when did your parents move to the States?
So my mom moved here when she was in my grandmother's stomach. So she was born here, and my dad moved here when he was 16. So he kind of was a trans. He injected himself during high school, which is the hardest time to come and immigrate, really. And so he also felt really part of two worlds. Yeah. So I recognize that.
And did you feel like maybe your dad more than your mom carried that, like, his former life with him and, like, mentality-wise?
100%.
Yeah.
And even my mom, I felt like, carried that immigrant mentality.
Through her parents.
Through her parents, for sure. And so growing up as a child of basically immigrants, I felt like I thought about the world through this perspective of trying to survive or trying to be the good child to deliver something better for your family.
Yeah.
Even though my upbringing was very different than how my dad was brought up.
Yeah.
Like, he escaped communism and then he came to the States early.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's the undertones of, like, survival, how to really have a better life and make sure you conserve and save rather than take risks. And so, like, those are such different perspectives than I had.
Yeah.
And it definitely causes chasm as me and my dad kind of grew up, really.
Yeah.
And we found our way back together, but it was hard.
Yeah, and it's super interesting. So my parents both grew up in Iran, and they're pretty similar story. I mean, they had to leave in the late 70s during the revolution. They both ended up in Italy, actually, in Florence, and met there, got married there. Me and my brother were actually born in Italy, and then we moved to LA when I was 6 and my brother was 4. And I always felt that way growing up, especially, you know, as an older sibling. So it was a little bit different where my parents are also learning English. And, like, I was also, you know.
Yeah.
And, of course, I learned it more quickly. And then, like, I had this, like, feeling of, like, oh, like, why am I different than everyone else? You know, even though I learned English quickly, it's like, oh, everyone's already from here, or you're in LA and, like, there's so much success around, but your parents just moved here and are trying to, they've already made sacrifices, right? They moved to a new country when they were, like, in their early 40s, didn't speak the language, all this stuff. So I always felt like sort of that, like you said, like the chip on my shoulder type thing, but also like, oh, I have to prove myself, whether that was, like, in social environments to my friends or to my parents. I feel like my parents were very support, like, you know, it was like pretty easy with me because I was just always, like, trying really hard. But I did, identity wise, I was confused a bit of just like, oh, so am I American? Or, you know, even, you know, my friends that are Persian here, like, felt very different than me because, like, I'm the only one who moved here. So I could definitely relate with that.
Yeah, I even went to Chinese school when I was growing up, and I was not Chinese.
Yeah.
But, I was not American enough.
And you, like, didn't fit in either place fully. Yeah. And it's, like, this dual thing, which I think is, like, really hard for kids, you know? So it's, like, so hard to deal with because, like, you know, as a kid, you just want to fit in. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the main goal is to fit in. And then I think the opportunity when you grow up is to see, like, how unique you are and actually, like, be more of your true self over time. But I think I found myself like, oh, like, I need to be this way, or I need to be this way, or I need to, like, oh, like, I'm embarrassed when my parents are there, or I'm this and this. And I think you can't control those things as a kid, you know. It's just like what's in your head or what people say at school or whatever. So it very challenging for sure.
I mean, I internalized that growing up as, well, I should be a certain way to try and either appease then my parents or the people around me. And I felt like I was always trying to suppress, I feel like, what made me shine. And it always, I think it colored kind of this perspective of, well, just kind of sit back and just do what you need to do. But that's such the opposite of what my character is, and I felt like what an entrepreneur is and what was already budding inside me, that I had to explore that for myself. And even to the point of my parents wanted me to be a doctor, like a good any good Asian is. And I did, and I tried to do that, but in the end I just realized I wasn't going to. And I chose, I was like, I'm not going to be a doctor, I'm going a different route. And when I even remember starting health aid in business school, I had a very cushy corporate job, And my dad just thought I was crazy. He thought I was either heartbroken, depressed, just in a temporary state of like, what, you know, gone crazy. And so I just remember having this like what seemed like World War III at the time.
Yeah.
And I take it back to, you know, his upbringing. He just wanted me to be safe. He wanted me to feel secure. And I wanted to break free from what was traditional or what was safe. And I wanted to take those risks for myself because I never felt like I was, you know, forging my own path because I was always living between two worlds.
Yeah, it's so hard, I think. Especially for our parents, because, like, you know, by the time we grow up, they're much older than us, and it's very hard to change your ways. I mean, even for myself, I mean, I started therapy like 2.5 years ago, and I would say pretty unaware of a lot of things, even though I thought I was a very aware person of myself.
Yeah.
And even to try to change some of those maybe early life beliefs that are still with me today, like, is so hard. And I see like myself making progress, but I feel like, you know, I'm 29. Like, if I was 59, like, it would probably be nearly impossible. And so, you know, even now, like, being able to talk to my parents about different things and understanding that, like, their experience is their experience, so they're not going to be able to fully change from the experiences they've had, whether it's their relationship with their home country, their relationship with the U.S., their relationship with safety, money, all of those things, they're very hard to change, you know? And I think that all I can focus on is continuing to improve myself. And me and my brother have been very lucky that my parents weren't as typical in that, like, oh, you have to do this or you have to do that, which is very underrated in how helpful that is, because I'm sure, like, it was super challenging for you.
Yeah, no, I mean, therapy is a huge point because I started it on and off a couple years ago in building Health Aid. I used executive coaches to help me in the building of Health Aid, but I really dove into therapy in the last year.
Yeah.
And it's given me the tools and, like you said, the awareness when I already thought I was pretty aware. And also, like, the perspective of, like, where they're coming from to just feel like, okay, I won't change them, but how do I, what's my reaction to that? And how do I want to show up in those instances? Yeah. And it's made my relationship grow, I think, closer to my dad. And my mom's no longer here, but I think about, you know, how she was, and she was just an optimist in everything. She is my optimism goals.
Yeah.
And I just think about her and a lot of what I do, because when you think about growing up in, you know, hard times where you have to be resilient, I think about kind of her perspective, and now I can see it so much more clearly. And I appreciate it a lot more too.
You know, I think it's very hard to change others, like you said, but I think if, like, if something that your parents say, like, really bothers you, it's also there's something inside of you that you need to be thinking or talking about to be able to work through, you know, like, why do those things bother you and all of those pieces? Because you can't assume that they're going to change. All you can do is, like, why am I, why does this bother me so much? And a lot of this stuff is very hard to understand why, because it's something from when you're 3 or 4 or 5. Yeah. And it's like, you know, they're like these, like, small, like, traumas or whatever that, like, you have to find within yourself and work through, or else, like, you can't expect, like, every single time your dad says X or your mom says Y, you're gonna be like, oh my god, like, why, you know, and, like, freak out. And I find myself, like, being more easily triggered from situations that, you know, tie back to my childhood, even if I don't realize how exactly, with the people that are closest to me, you know.
And
I think for guys especially, I think, you know, like, moms, you know, like, dealing with moms, and I have an amazing mom who's been very supportive, but, you know, guys are always, like, a little bit more triggered by their mom right away. And I'm like, I always try to figure out why, because if, you know, if you said the same thing to me, I wouldn't freak out at all.
Yeah.
So it's like these little things that I feel like are, if you don't look within yourself, you'll never find, and someone helping you do that is way more efficient.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's, thank goodness for my therapist. And you're right, like, I think about what my dad would say, and I didn't realize this, but looking back, I think a lot of why I did what I did to achieve, to either get here with Health Aid, start Health Aid, do, you know, achieve in school, was either to spite my dad or to prove something to my dad. And that's such a not fulfilling way to live. And so my therapist really has really helped me see I don't need that type of external motivation. There is something fulfilling in just the pure joy of whatever it is and what it means to me versus, you know, putting it up against the backdrop of spiting or triggers or something from someone so close to you, like parents.
Yeah, and I think it's tough because everyone has different relationships with their siblings and parents, and I think they say that, like, the child, you know, like, the story of the child is, like, seen clearly through, like, oh, like, what were the parents like and who were they, you know? And then it's like, oh, it can map to my story or story, because it's like, oh, we learned these things early on, like, oh, achievement, you know, like, achievement was one of those things. It's like, of course, anyone who starts a company for the most part is ambitious, but, like, what are they trying to prove, you know? Are they doing it because they love it? Sure, like, maybe some of it, but what else, you know, what's there? And I think, especially with immigrants or children of immigrants, it's like, you have this, like, drive, chip on your shoulder, where one side of it could be very healthy. The other side could be, like, overworking, like, overdoing it, telling your body, oh, I'm not good enough because, like, my company's not there yet, or I'm not good, or I need to keep getting better, you know? So definitely, like, both sides to it.
Yeah, I know. The unhealthy side for sure. I remember my cortisol levels and inflammation markers were, like, soaring high in the heat of just building Health Aid. And we would just push ourselves to the max. I'm sure, you know, you probably had those days. Yeah. And it's like, for what? For why? Yeah. To prove something. To who? Yeah. You know?
And I think it's just, like, hopefully, like, as you, any entrepreneur gets older, they figure out, like, the best way to work for them, you know? Because I think if you're really going to have anything that's successful, it's going to take at least 10 years, if not more. I think I always had this conception that, like, oh, maybe 5 years, maybe it's faster, like, whatever. And we're at 6 now. I'm like, this is just getting started.
Yeah.
And so, like, I can't work in the way that I thought. And also, like, rest and my ability to, like, rest in certain times actually, like, makes it way better when I am working. And finding that, like, balance. I think we got super lucky because we started the company when we were really young. That comes with a lot of pros, which is, like, we have time and we can figure it out. The cons are, like, we don't know anything else. We have no other experiences, so what do we compare it to? And so definitely that, like, support and being able to learn and grow has been super helpful.
Yeah, and you bring up that point around, like, that rest period. It's a, I think everyone thinks it's a sprint the whole time.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's not an overnight success.
Yeah.
It's not even a 2-year, 5-year, right? It's a who knows how long success, right? And so your great brands are built from this, I think, like, pivot, like, rest, pivot, move quickly. And when you know you're going to move quickly.
For sure.
And I think that's what me and my co-founders have done with Health Aid, is try and move quickly, but know that we need to regroup.
Yeah.
Both as a business and then personally, because how else do you last in this, like, race that seems to never end, right?
Yeah.
And it is just that. It's that patience leads to that progress that you need to see that's transformational in a business.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm curious, like, what point in your life did you feel like was kind of the biggest crossroads? You mentioned some stuff with your dad. Was that around the time that you were thinking of starting Health Aid? Or, like, what was, like, that moment for you where you look back and you're like, this was a true low for me and I'm very thankful for it, but, like, this time in my life, you know, was really hard?
Yeah, I have a few. I think one was when I decided to start Health Aid. I was going to business school at the time at USC. I was working a, you know, great corporate job.
That what
was
pretty were you cushy. Doing?
I was in pharmaceutical sales, and it was a lot of disposable income for a 25-year-old at that time. And I'm like, why would anyone leave that type of paycheck? But I knew there was something else out there for me. And I remember clearly I was at the mobile station on Bronson and Sunset. And it was like 10 o'clock at night. I was about to go into my friend's birthday party. And I just remember telling my parents, I was like, I'm gonna leave my business on Monday. I'm gonna, you know, put in my 2 weeks notice. I'm gonna do Health Aid full time. And I just remember having what became an hour and a half crying session, yelling session around what my life was going to look like, because they just had fears of what it was going to be, or myself trying to plead to them to be on my side.
Yeah.
And I just remember feeling so alone at that time that I left that call just thinking, well, there's no other way than just do the fucking shit and like succeed.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to be on my own, I'm going to do it. But I knew I wasn't on my own. Yeah. It just felt like that. So that was really the start of true Health Aid, I feel like, when me and my co-founders decide to leave our jobs. And then That was one big one.
But like, what did that mean? You know, because it's on one hand very exciting because you're starting a company. On one hand, scary, not only the financial impact, but your family and like, are they supporting you? Like, what was that like emotional journey for you of like getting to a place of like comfort, at least within yourself, of like, hey, I'm doing this, so it is what it is.
Yeah. So I think you bring up the financial impact. Like, I needed to know, like, okay, I had a runway for myself. I wasn't just going to live on the street. I was in school. So what I ended up doing is taking a student loan out to fund myself and the business, like for a year and a half. I gave myself a year and a half. If this is going to succeed in that time, great. I'll just move on with the competency that I know I have to the next thing of whatever that is.
Yeah.
So that gave me some cushion. Two is, I think that conversation with my parents and just feeling so alone gave me this fire that I was going to do anything to prove at least my dad in that instance wrong.
Yeah.
And that fire kept me going for a long time.
Yeah.
But then also I knew that there was a lot of demand and excitement with the brand already. It was probably the middle of 2013 at that point.
Yeah.
And so I knew in my gut there was something here with the brand. Mm. And if I didn't explore it or take this to the end of wherever that natural journey was, I was going to regret it. And it was that seed of regret that I never want to live with.
Yeah.
And so that was also there to leave me at peace with, I'm making this decision.
Yeah.
And I feel good about it.
Yeah.
And not just good, but we're doing it. And Monday morning I got up to just tackle the day with Health Aid.
Yeah, it's such a good point because especially when you're younger, and of course you're in business school, but on the relative scale, you're so young. So like failing at something matters a lot less when you're 25 than 35 or 45 or have a family. And I think the ability, I guess, that you had in that time to go against your parents, which, you know, growing up is very hard to do, especially like when you're still pretty young, to avoid the future, even worse feeling of regret, I think is very admirable and is a hard thing because I think a lot of people that we talk to, it's like so hard to make that initial jump, whether it's fear of parents, fear of financial health, fear of what their friends are going to think. But like without that, there's nothing.
Yeah, yeah. And you're so true. You're so right. A lot of people don't take that first step.
Yeah.
And it's that first step that opens up so much of what you could do. And there was a lot of clarity actually in that first step that I didn't realize. And that was a kind of duality of this such a low moment with what I felt like was alone with my parents versus the opportunity.
Yeah.
And so I was excited by that.
Yeah.
And many times in Health Aid, I feel like there are many lows. I think with me and my co-founders, one low time was like from like a physical production standpoint, like we were going to be shut down. Like we had no more product. And it's like, is our company going to fail? Are we going to go bankrupt?
Yeah.
So much like responsibility, obligation, desire to make sure our family and friends, investors were delivered upon. And it was in those moments that you're just like, okay, we have to pivot. We have to take that next step.
Mm.
And it's that next step that you feel that clarity. Mm. But it's tough to take, to see that and have the courage to do that. And, you know, picking yourself up and having people help you in that way is nice.
I mean, I think the fact that things are more complex than just one feeling. Like when you started your brand, you felt the clarity that I know I want to start it. But then there's also the anger or worry with your parents or your dad, and you're like, why is he not supporting me? Or I feel like sad about this but happy about that. And a lot of what we talk about as a brand is obviously the spectrum of feelings, emotions, and things are complex. They're not just one thing. There's so much gray area. And then of course with a startup, like the sheer amount of pressure that you go through. And even though each year you look back and you're like, damn, I didn't know anything last year, and like hopefully you're, and the good thing about starting a company is that will be true every year.
Ain't that the truth?
Yeah, it's funny because there's so many hard moments, and each moment at the time, or at times, feels unsurmountable. You know, we're not getting past this. Like, I'm sure you had that feeling. It's like, we can't produce this stuff. Like, it's done. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, and it's like, then you do get past it, and usually, like, a year later, you barely remember that thing that happened. But it's like such a crazy, intense human experience because you have to go through so much with a few people. And of course, the relationship gets more complicated with your co-founders and with the rest of your team because of the pressure and because of everything externally, that it's just such a journey. And I think people really, the people that make it through that, I think have learned a lot about themselves as well throughout that process.
Yeah, that spectrum of emotion that you talk about is so real. And I didn't come to understand it until the journey of entrepreneurship. Yeah. It's like every day is a new emotion.
Yeah.
And every within an hour, you could feel so many things.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like the beauty, and also like kind of that mad happy feeling, maybe. Yeah. Like that duality of it,
for
right?
Sure.
That, you know, I had to have many different, like an executive coach, a therapist, my co-founders, yeah, like different sources to help me process all of it.
Yeah.
I'm curious, how do you process all those spectrum of emotions?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, they say that entrepreneurship or startups are like really high highs, really low lows, nothing in between. And I think for the most part, that's true. And I think it's like over time developing the tools yourself and having the support. So I think for me, from the very beginning, I think like the physical health part was a part of my life in terms of whether I was working out or playing basketball. And I think that that was one piece that was good enough for the beginning. But then I think over time it was like, okay, how do we work on our relationship as founders, right? Like that's a big component of it.
Yeah.
How do we work on our ability to lead a growing team, whether it be coaching or support from other investors? How do we get support in our personal lives, whether that's parents or significant others? All of those made a huge impact for me. And then I think the biggest thing was in 2021, or 2020, when I started therapy, I feel like for me, you know, I had never dealt with true crisis in my life. And a lot of what I learned through the brand is like, you want to start therapy before that, obviously. Mm-hmm. You want to have the tools yourself because you're going to deal with challenging things throughout your life. And I've gone every week basically for 2.5 years, and it's been very helpful for me to both have that time and then through that not only learn about myself but learn how to have the ability to do this for a really long time. You know, and I feel very lucky to have learned that at a relatively early age, because these are like tools for life, not just tools for a startup. And it allows me to build my life in a way where hopefully I can have, you know, the ups and downs are going to always happen, but I can better handle them each year. And I can learn more about myself each year to know like the positions to put myself in to hopefully be successful.
Yeah, those tools for life is so true, because it's not just in the business. It's how you deal with your significant other, family.
I mean, everything. Everything's very connected. And I think when you're doing a startup, there's so much pressure. So it makes those other things harder because you have less time to do those things. So it's like, I know that right now, like I put in as much time as I can with my parents or my significant other or working out or my mental health, but it's not as much as I could if I wasn't doing this. So it's like, how do I get it to a level that feels great for me right now, not where I want it to be in the future? And I think that's an ongoing challenge, you know, and like something's got to give at some points. Sometimes you feel more tired than others, all of those things.
Yeah, you're right. It is like something's got to give. It's, and also it ebbs and flows, I feel like, right? Like some days you're just like, oh, I gave more to myself today. I'm feeling guilty for the business. I didn't give enough. It's always going to be that ebb and flow.
Yeah. And for you now, I guess as you think about the future, yourself, your family, like how you want to live your life, not only with work, but just generally and like becoming more of who you are, or who you know you are inside as you learn more. How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, that's very top of mind for me, actually, because I have since exited the business. And you know, what health aid taught me is that you can put your all into something and you can, you know, you be the sacrificial lamb and it can have a great outcome. But you also don't have to do that to have a great outcome, too.
Totally.
And so for me, like, I do want to instill those values of like hard work, being present, being resilient, really to my kids. And like, so I think it's important to be a good model of what it means to take care of yourself, to show up, to be as present as you can, and to experience things rather than just be on the sidelines.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of with those ideas and values that I'm trying to be a model for my kids.
Yeah.
And I'm using therapy a lot as like a way to kind of break some of those generational,
for sure,
you know, observations, traumas. Right? Traumas. Yeah. And so I'm really trying to be mindful of how I want to communicate, how I'm emotionally available,
yeah.
Both to myself, my kids, and my significant other.
Yeah.
And I think it's a practice that I'm really trying to work on right now. And the idea of rest and the idea of, as I invest and advise other companies, as I think about other businesses, I want to be able to, you know, at least put boundaries on what I need to feel whole, yeah. rather than let it overtake me.
Yeah. I mean, it's so true. I think, you know, oftentimes talking to parents, you know, on the show and just hearing about how hard it is maybe to, you know, you have this idea of what you don't want to do that your parents did, but maybe sometimes it's hard to do that, or you catch yourself like, oh, like, why am I doing this? Or like, it's because like, it's the only parent-child relationship you really knew, you know, and it's really hard to break those ties and change it and build it in a new way. And I feel like the only way to do that is through awareness of yourself, whether that's your own practice of meditation, working out, or therapy, and more specific help, because I think how you show up in one place of your life is how you show up in all the places, even if you don't think there's that direct connection. And unless you're happy and content with yourself and who you are today, not always telling yourself that you need to be better, then you're not going to be able to show up for other people either.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. And, you know, if kind of like you put your oxygen mask on first when you're on an airplane,
totally.
It's the idea that you're taking care of yourself. And that's in of itself a good model for the people around you.
Yeah. How do you think about the companies you've invested in and been a part of and what you've tried to help with?
Yeah, I think so. I look at it from the perspective of I like backing people who are, well, mostly I love female founders, Asian American entrepreneurs. Yeah. That is me at its core. So I love kind of that energy and that demographic.
What are some of the brands?
Fly by Jing is a brand that I love. Win Coffee is another one. Yeah. Omsom, a few others kind of in that space, mostly food and beverage.
Yeah.
I just invested in Boomo as well. And I think at its core, they all have a message.
Yeah.
And it's not just a product that they're trying to sling. It's a message that's foundational and core to not just who they are as founders, but there's this deeper why. So I resonate with that.
Yeah.
And when I think about the companies I love, it's like, do I love the product? Do I love the founders and kind of the story they're bringing to the table? And do I think they have legs to like scale and make it? I don't do some deep due diligence.
Yeah.
But those are kind of like the three kind of core tenets of like how I get in a brand. And then when I work with brands, it's mostly around, well, here's my experience and here's the really bad example of what happened to Health Aid.
Yeah.
Maybe you can avoid that mistake.
Yeah.
Or it's a lot of experience shares.
For sure.
And it's definitely not, oh, here's what I think you should do, because that's such a hard trigger word for me, that I don't want to come from that perspective.
Yeah.
It's just a lot about what I've been through, what we've been through, what to watch out for. And that's mostly in that way, being a sounding board more than anything. And I mean, even for me, I remember those people that I talked to, I like to feel validated and just feel like there was someone who knew the feeling that I had.
Yeah.
And that is all that made it okay.
Yeah, the support of just someone who's been through the experience is so important, and just like can feel what you're going through and isn't like judging you because something didn't do well. Because I think most typical investors who haven't started a brand, like, they don't get all the lows because they never even hear about them for the most part in a company.
Yeah.
And I think even for me, it's always helpful when I'm talking to people who are starting new brands or who have recently started brands. It's like, it also helps me to share my experience. It almost like makes me remember it and like process it more. And it's a cool feeling. And also I think the ability to give back, you know, I've never been someone who like wants to like gate information. Like, I don't think that if our brand is successful, yours can't be, or vice versa. Like, you know, I never think that like, oh, like what if they do well? Like, I think it's awesome to be able to give back. And so many people did that for us, even giving us a chance when we were a tiny brand. Like, and so it always feels good to be able to give back in some way.
Yeah, that's totally the feeling that I have too. And
when
I started, there was no other kind of Asian American entrepreneur that I feel like I could really kind of resonate with. And I love kind of this movement of these kind of like rising tides of other brands. Amazing, that yeah. I am very happy to give my and share my experience, because like you, like I don't want to hold it and hoard it. What good is that?
Yeah.
And so to see these other brands really flourishing is so powerful.
Yeah. I love Emmy, if you know
yeah.
that product. It's
yeah,
amazing. Yeah. And they're great. As well as Sanzo, great products. And I feel like there's so much happening in the space now that is actually tying back to the origins of where those people came from versus, you know, even back then, I'm sure when you started, you weren't thinking like, how can I connect this to my roots?
Yeah.
It was just like, I'm starting a brand
right.
here, you
yeah.
know, and it's cool to be able to see that like developing now.
Yeah. I mean, I was just in New York with all of those brands actually. Yeah. And there was this kind of conference of these Asian American entrepreneurs really talking and touting their heritage, where they came from, these products that really showcased it. And I think it's so beautiful. And you can kind of wear that flag of pride
yeah.
And be who you are. And I think at the end of the day, that is the ultimate expression of just optimism and creativity and pride.
Yeah, it's awesome. Before we wrap up, I'm curious, like, now that you've exited the business, like, how do you think about the future for HealthAid? And, you know, where is HealthAid in 5 years and 10 years, and where is it going?
Yeah. I mean, we've always said HealthAid could be in every fridge in America. Mm. We've yet to accomplish that.
Yeah.
So I think we're still on that journey.
Totally.
And it's still with this idea of following your gut. Like, that is not just a trademark tagline, but
yeah.
a tagline that still fits so well with who we are at our core. There's still so much energy and excitement around gut health science, and linking that to kind of what consumers are looking for is that foundational understanding about who they are, what they can rely on. And that's always going to be your own gut and kind of following your true north. And I think it's that message that HealthAid will always lean on and push forward.
Yeah.
And so I'm excited to see HealthAid really further the message around probiotics and gut health
yeah.
in the mainstream further.
For sure. Two questions we ask everyone as we wrap up. Is there anyone that you found their story to be amazing, and whether you know them or not, you think would be powerful to share on the Mad Happy podcast?
Well, I mentioned her a couple times, but Jing and Flyby Jing
yeah.
is just an awesome storyteller. Really, her roots and her palette and what she's trying to do to change the dialogue around Chinese flavors
yeah.
is, I think, really unique. And she's really been on the forefront of doing that. And now you see an explosion of not just chili crisps, but condiments and kind of condiments being kind of the hot area.
Totally.
So I love her story. And I think there's also a really strong story with Win Coffee and what she's trying to tell with the Robusta bean and Vietnamese coffee and the roots of that
yeah.
that not a lot of people know here.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Definitely got to get them on.
Yeah.
The last question we ask everyone is, what makes you mad happy?
Oh, wow. Okay, so mad happy to me is kind of this duality of this like angering but like super intense happiness. And I have to say it's my kids, because there's nothing more beautiful than seeing them thrive and grow. And I have two under the age of three, so it's
yeah,
not
wow.
every day.
Yeah.
And so, but they're also the most frustrating things ever.
Yeah.
So it's much like growing a company too. It's like the most beautiful, happy thing that you probably will never want to be anywhere else.
Yeah.
But it's also maddening as all hell.
Yeah.
And you just wonder, you know, when am I going to get a break?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an amazing place to leave it. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciate it. And it was great to hear your story on the
Thanks
show.
Thanks for having me. It's so fun.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you, everyone. And we'll talk next week. Thank you guys so much for listening. As always, really, really appreciate it. And thank you for all the feedback and the support over the past 100 plus episodes. And we're continuing to work on more. So if you have questions you want us to answer, or anything that is on your mind, definitely let us know. And until next week, where we'll have another great conversation coming up. Thanks so much.
The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.